headlines this hour. Iran's most senior military commander visits an underground base which houses a huge fleet of cutting-edge Iranian drones. One day ahead of Israel's flag march, Palestinian groups warn that they are ready for confrontation as Israel refuses to change the planned route of the parade. Also, the battle for Ukraine's Donbas region intensifies as Russia captures the strategic town of Lyman en route to two key cities still under Kyiv's control. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. The Iranian military has turned to the number one drone power in the region. Chairman of the Armed Forces Joint Chiefs of Staff, Major General Mohammad Bagheri, has paid a visit to an underground drone base. The top general got a first-hand account of the Iranian Army's cutting-edge capabilities in the development of different types of military, combat, and long-range drones. Images released show the Kaiman 12 drone with a flight endurance of 12 hours. It is capable of carrying four domestically produced bombs and missiles. Iran has always stressed such programs are part of boosting the country's defenses. The fate of the 2015 Iran deal remains far from clear as talks between Tehran and the P4+1 group are stalled. As we will see in the next report, Iran says the main remaining issue in the talks is about its right to economic and trade benefits under the JCPOA.
Talks to revive the 2015 Iran deal, known as a Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, remain stalled after a year of intensive diplomacy. Senior diplomats from Iran and the P4+1 group, namely Russia, China, Britain, France, and Germany, have held many rounds of talks in the Austrian capital, Vienna. The diplomatic initiative to restore the deal has become a long and complex saga. Whether negotiators will finally cross the finishing line is anyone's guess. All parties have acknowledged that there are a few remaining gaps that need to be bridged between Washington and Tehran before the deal emerges. But what's keeping the talks from further progress? It has been repeatedly said that Washington's refusal to remove Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps from its terrorism blacklist is the most important sticking point. But Iran's top diplomat has given a vastly different account of what is blocking the path of the negotiations. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian told the World Economic Forum on Thursday that the issue of the IRGC being on the U.S. blacklist of terrorist groups is a minor issue that has been exaggerated and magnified by the Israeli lobby, and that Iran's top priority is the interests of the nation. He also warned that American interests and foreign policy have been taken hostage by the Israeli regime. Israel has made no secret of its opposition to the 2015 deal and diplomacy with Iran. It has been engaged in a not-so-covert campaign to derail the Vienna negotiations.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian stresses that what has caused the pause in the negotiations is Iran's economic and trade demands, and the most important remaining issue is the effective removal of economic sanctions. The top diplomat says the maximum pressure campaign launched by former U.S. President Donald Trump must end. He says the window of diplomacy is still open, adding that Americans know what they need to do.
U.S. President Joe Biden was a vociferous critic of Trump's unilateral withdrawal from the JCPOA in May 2018. During his presidential campaign, he pledged to work to rejoin the agreement. But has he done so? Iran's top diplomat says that has not been the case so far.
The fact that the United States, under the Biden administration, has failed to return to compliance with the agreement shows that the United States is not really interested in a rules-based international order, because one of the most basic pillars of international law by the United States' own agreement are United Nations Security Council resolutions. And again, it's binding.
Amir Abdullahian told the World Economic Forum that Biden's policy towards Iran has not been different from Trump's hostile approach. The Iranian foreign minister said the U.S. president must decide now whether he wants to waste time or courageously return to complying with U.S. commitments under the 2015 deal. His comments come after U.S. Special Envoy for Iran Robert Malley said the prospects of a return to the Iran nuclear deal are tenuous at best. Malley made the remarks on the same day that the Biden administration unveiled new sanctions on Iran. The U.S. Special Envoy for Iran noted, however, that Washington still believes it is in the national security interests of the United States to try to salvage the 2015 agreement. The future of the hard-earned international deal remains unclear and could unravel completely if Washington fails to return to its commitments. Meanwhile, Israel is doing its utmost to prevent any deal between Washington and Iran, just as it did before the JCPOA came into existence in 2015.
No group and no block of people has more power and influence in the United States than Jewish leaders in shaping how Americans think and American attitudes. And that's not only true, but it's especially true with regard to Iran. The American media is overwhelmingly very hostile to Iran. And this is in keeping with what Jewish leaders and all those who support Israel really want.
Will the administration of Joe Biden be able to withstand pressure exerted by the Israeli lobby and act based on America's national interests?
Palestinian resistance groups are warning Israel ahead of the regime's provocative flag march in occupied outlets. Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and other Palestinian groups say that they would retaliate if Israel does not change the planned route of the parade and tries to approach Al-Aqsa Mosque. People's Youth Movement in Al-Quds says it wants Sunday to be remembered as Palestinian Flag Day by raising the national flag on every house, square, and street. Israeli groups hold annual events to commemorate the occupation of the Old City and other Palestinian neighborhoods in 1967. A similar rally last year ended with Israeli crackdown and retaliatory rocket attacks by Hamas that led to an 11-day war on Gaza. Regime officials say that a series of raids and arrests are expected across the occupied territories ahead of the planned march. Our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, says that Israelis have vowed to go ahead with the march in the Old City. They have even threatened to raid the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Well, first of all, there were numerous efforts in order to cancel this Israeli flag march, but it failed. Now, the Palestinian groups and the Hamas movement are demanding the Israeli regime to change the route of the flag march, not to allow the Israeli settlers to enter and march through the narrowest streets of the old town of Al-Quds, the eastern part of Al-Quds, where Palestinians live there, and not to come and raid the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex, Al-Haram al-Sharif, that is known by the Israelis as the Western Wall area. Up till the moment, there were statements from the Israeli police, the Israeli Knesset members, Israeli lawmakers, of course, are saying that the Hamas threats did not intimidate the Israelis, and they will continue. They will go ahead with the march. Nothing will change. Now, there is this Israeli far-right-wing lawmaker, Ben-Gavir. This Israeli settler is well-known for trying every time to storm the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex with a number of Israeli settlers under the protection of Israeli police. This time, he's demanding that he has the right to at least raid the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex even before the start of the flag march.
This day 94 of the Russia-Ukraine war, Russian forces are making advances in eastern Ukraine. Let's take a look at the latest developments. Russian forces and their allies have gained full control of the town of Lyman in the Donetsk region. That's according to the Russian Defense Ministry. The railway hub lies on the road to the key cities of Slovyansk and Kramatorsk, which are still under Kyiv's control. It is also located 40 kilometers west of the largest Donbas city of Severodonetsk, the current focus of the Russian offensive in the east. Luhansk governor says that Russian troops have entered Severodonetsk. He says Ukrainian forces may have to retreat from the strategic city to avoid capture. Russia launched its military operation in Ukraine in late February. The war has displaced over 12 million Ukrainians, more than half of them internally. Ukraine's president says his country will do whatever it takes to defend the eastern region of Donbas, where Russian forces are conducting a fierce offensive. Volodymyr Zelensky has accused Moscow of carrying out genocide in Donbas. He says the Russians have concentrated maximum artillery and reserves in that region, targeting it with missile strikes and aircraft attacks. The fighting in Donbas has been raging over the past few weeks. Some Ukrainian officials say Kyiv's troops may now have to retreat from some key areas to avoid being captured. Some 10,000 Russian troops are reportedly stationed in Donbas. That makes up the Luhansk and Donetsk provinces. Our correspondent Johnny Miller joined us from Donetsk province in eastern Ukraine with details on the situation there. Let's take a listen.
The long-awaited, the long-talked-about encirclement of Ukrainian troops in the Donbas looks like it's happening. And while there's been many Ukrainian units over recent days posting on the internet saying that they are refusing to fight, even from the official hierarchy now, they're saying that they're looking at a full withdrawal. NATO is still determined to supply Ukraine with weapons, particularly the United States and Britain. There's been a number of weapon systems delivered to the Ukrainians over recent weeks and months, which were supposed to be game changers. That hasn't happened. Well, the Americans are now saying they're going to send high-tech, long-range artillery. We'll have to see whether that changes anything. But also, there's interestingly a bit of a split within NATO. While Britain, France, Poland, some of the Baltic states like Estonia seem determined to do whatever they can to help Ukraine defeat Russia, powerhouses of the EU, France and Germany, are less interested in supporting Ukraine.
The Russian president says Moscow is ready to help find ways to ship grain stuck in Ukrainian ports during the conflict. Vladimir Putin made the announcement in a phone call with his French counterpart Emmanuel Macron and the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz. Putin said that Russia is also ready to help reduce tensions in the global food market by increasing its export of fertilizers and agricultural products. He said this, however, requires the removal of relevant Western sanctions on Russia. Putin pointed to the Western arms supplies to Ukraine, warning that they risk, quote, further destabilization. He also touched upon stalled diplomatic efforts aimed at ending the war with Ukraine, saying that Moscow is ready to resume negotiations. Scholz and Macron asked Putin to hold serious and direct negotiations with the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. North Korea reports a drop in the number of new fever cases as it battles its first-ever COVID outbreak since the beginning of the pandemic. Local media say that over 88,500 people showed fever symptoms on Friday. The figure dropped to below 100,000 for the first time since North Korea began reporting daily new cases on May 12. No additional deaths have been registered. So far, the country has logged over 3.4 million fever cases and 69 deaths. 2 weeks ago, Pyongyang declared a state of emergency and imposed a national lockdown after it confirmed its first COVID cases. The government says the COVID outbreak is now under control. The UN Special Rapporteur, in his visit to Afghanistan, has warned about humanitarian and economic crises in the country. Richard Bennett has called on the international community to continue to provide humanitarian support to Afghanistan in order to protect the Afghan people in the face of sanctions on the Taliban. Rahmatullah Bagban reports from Kabul.
The UN Special Rapporteur on the Situation of Human Rights in Afghanistan has concluded his 11-day trip to the country. Holding a press conference in Kabul, Richard Bennett expressed concern about the violation of human rights in Afghanistan, calling on the Taliban to abide by their promises.
Afghanistan is facing a plethora of critical human rights challenges that are having a severe impact on the population. I urge the authorities to acknowledge the human rights challenges that they are facing and to close the gap between their words and their deeds.
Mr. Bennett also called for investigation into blind terror attacks in the country, saying systematic attacks on Shia Hazaras involve marks of crimes against humanity.
I call for investigations into a series of attacks on places of worship and schools in Kabul, Kunduz, and Balkh provinces, instances of which have been claimed by the ISISK group. In particular, such attacks specifically targeting members of the Hazara, Shia, and Sufi communities are becoming increasingly systematic in nature and reflect elements of an organizational policy, thus bearing the hallmarks of crimes against humanity.
The UN expert also urged the international community to continue relief funds to Afghanistan, saying sanctions on the Taliban should not harm the Afghan people.
The humanitarian and economic crisis is very concerning, and I call on the international community to continue to provide humanitarian support and to ensure that the implementation of applicable sanctions do not substantially impede the provision of essential public services accessible to all, which are necessary for the enjoyment of human rights.
The independent expert advised the Taliban to form an inclusive government and establish fair engagement with the people if they want to end instability and suffering on Afghan soil. The UN expert's trip to Afghanistan comes as the country has been facing rights violations in different aspects. Afghan people hope their rights are protected and the international community closely watches developments in the country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
And with that, we come to an end for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
In an advertisement released last year, Blake Masters, a leading candidate in Arizona's Republican Senate primary, cradles a semi-automatic weapon. "This is a short-barreled rifle," he said. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times opinion columnist Michelle Goldberg. The piece is titled, America May Be Broken Beyond Repair. Advertisement released last year, Blake Masters, a leading candidate in Arizona's Republican Senate primary, cradles a semi-automatic weapon. This is a short-barreled rifle, he said, ominous music playing in the background. It wasn't designed for hunting. This is designed to kill people. For Blake Masters, this isn't an argument against allowing such guns to proliferate. Rather, it's an acknowledgement of why access to these weapons is, for the right, a matter of existential importance. The Second Amendment is not about duck hunting, said Masters. It's about protecting your family and your country. What's the first thing that the Taliban did when Joe Biden handed them Afghanistan? They took away people's guns. Guns, in this worldview, are a guarantor against government overreach, and government overreach includes attempts to regulate guns. These days, it's barely remarkable when Republicans issue what sounds like threats against those who dare curtail their private arsenals. I have news for the embarrassment that claims to be our president. Try to take our guns and you'll learn why the Second Amendment was written in the first place, Randy Fine, a state representative in Florida, tweeted on Wednesday. It will be impossible to do anything about guns in this country, at least at a national level, as long as Democrats depend on the cooperation of a party that holds in reserve the possibility of insurrection. The slaughter of children in Texas has done little to alter this dynamic. Republicans have no intention of letting Democrats pass even modest measures, like strengthened background checks, as long as the Democratic senators Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema refuse to amend the filibuster. Republicans retain a veto over national policy. Victims of our increasingly frequent mass shootings are collateral damage in a cold civil war, though some Democrats refuse to acknowledge it, let alone fight it. Fine's words echoed Donald Trump's during the 2016 presidential election, when he said that Second Amendment people might be able to stop a President Hillary Clinton from appointing Supreme Court justices. What was once a barely concealed insinuation of violence has morphed, especially since 6 of January 2021, into an even more forthright menace. As ProPublica has reported, dozens of members of the Oath Keepers militia were arrested in connection with the attack on the Capitol. But that hasn't stopped the organization from evolving into a force within the Republican Party. In Shasta County, a conservative part of rural Northern California, a militia-aligned faction has secured a majority on the Board of Supervisors in what members of the movement see as a blueprint that can be deployed nationally. Throughout the country, reported the New York Times, right-wing Republicans are talking more openly and frequently about the use of force as justifiable in opposition to those who dislodged him, meaning Donald Trump, from power. Expecting those same Republicans to collaborate with Democrats on public safety is madness. The horrifying irony, the hideous ratchet, is that the more America is besieged by senseless violence, the more the paramilitary wing of the American right is strengthened. Gun sales in America tend to rise after mass shootings. Republicans responded to the massacre in Uvalde, Texas, by doubling down on calls to arm teachers and harden schools. An article in The Federalist argued that parents must homeschool so that kids can't learn in a controlled environment where guns can be safely carried for self-defense or locked away when not in use. It's a vision of a society, if you can call it that, where every family is a fortress. Guns are now the leading cause of death for American children, but many conservatives consider this a price worth paying for their version of freedom. Our institutions give these conservatives disproportionate power, whether or not they win elections. The filibuster renders the Senate largely impotent. Donald Trump, a former president who lost the popular vote, was able to appoint Supreme Court justices who are poised to help overturn a New York State law restricting the carrying of concealed weapons. It's increasingly hard to see a path to small-d democratic reform. And so among liberals, there's an overwhelming feeling of despair. Even as people learn the names of all those murdered children, the most common sentiment is not never again, but a bitter acknowledgement that nothing is going to change. America is too sick. It is too broken. It is perhaps beyond repair. Two years ago, David French, an anti-Trump conservative, published a book, Divided We Fall, warning of the possible crack-up of the United States. It included two chapters imagining scenarios for how the dissolution of the country might happen. One scenario involved a mass shooting at a school in California, to which the state's people reacted with white-hot rage. David French envisioned furious state politicians defying the Second Amendment, leading to a nullification crisis and blue state secession. He meant it as a cautionary tale, but rereading the chapter after Uvalde, Texas, it feels less bleak than our reality. In David French's scenario, atrocity has the effect of energizing people rather than immobilizing them. They are determined to fight, not resigned to defeat. They have audacity and hope. The real nightmare is not that the repetition of nihilist terrorism brings American politics to an inflection point, but that it doesn't. The nightmare is that we simply stumble on, helpless, as things keep getting worse.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
According to the latest Global Terrorism Index, there is an increase in terrorist attacks across sub-Saharan Africa amid concern that the region is now becoming the center of operations by armed groups affiliated to Daesh or ISIS and Al-Qaeda terrorist groups. Now, Western countries such as France and the United States have troops in Africa to ostensibly combat terrorists. However, due to an upsurge in terrorism, many in the continent are now questioning the real reasons behind the presence of these foreign troops. Meanwhile, civilians, especially women and children, are bearing the brunt of terrorist attacks in Africa. A Nigerian woman who is a victim of Boko Haram terrorist group speaks here inside a refugee camp. Hello and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. This week, we are focusing on an upsurge of terrorist attacks in Africa, especially in the volatile Sahel region. We are asking, what are the factors behind increasing terrorist attacks in the continent and how are Western imperialist powers linked to this deteriorating situation? In the second part of our program, we shall discuss the situation in Mali as the country's government pursues an independent policy. We are asking, is France, the former colonial power, undermining the government of Mali? Now, these are some of the questions our experts will be answering today.
an upsurge of terrorism in Africa. The 2022 Global Terrorism Index reveals that terrorism remains a serious threat, with sub-Saharan Africa accounting for 48% of total global deaths from terrorism. Four of the 10 countries with the largest increases in deaths from terrorism were also in sub-Saharan Africa, namely Niger, Mali, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Burkina Faso.
Following military defeats in Syria and Iraq, the notorious Daesh terrorist group shifted its attention to Africa's Sahel region, which is now the epicenter of terrorism. Gaswich, Mozambique in Southern Africa also witnessed deadly terrorist attacks over the last few years. A Mozambican here gives an account of his daring escape during a terrorist attack in the country's restive Cabo Delgado province.
Mesmo assim, no dia do ataque, eu já aquilo aconteceu enquanto já estive no centro de trabalho, estive trabalhando numa certa empresa. Então, quando aquilo aconteceu, eu logo já me escapei de lá, entrando na mata, já procurando refúgio. Então, até o momento, já não sei onde que a minha família está.
Well, to discuss increased terrorism in Africa and possible factors behind it, we contacted Nefta Freeman, a coordinating committee member of the Black Alliance for Peace. Thanks a lot, sir, for your time and for joining our program.
Thank you for having me.
Mr. Freeman, are you surprised that there is an upsurge of terrorism in Africa and particularly in sub-Saharan Africa?
Mm-hmm. Well, we have to recognize that the root causes of terrorism in Africa haven't been addressed. The root causes stem out of the legacy of how Europe underdeveloped Africa. I mean, we have to remember that, you know, if we believe that there are no really inferior people and the African people are not inferior, then we got to say that this comes from somewhere and it has to have its legacy in the underdevelopment that has been put on Africa by the Western countries, and that those conditions, the lack of self-determination and being dominated by the Western world still exists. So you, as a result of that, there's marginalization, there's economic despair in people. We know that there are high levels of unemployment.
Most of the terrorist groups operating in Africa, such as Boko Haram and Al-Shabaab, are linked to global terror networks, especially Daesh and Al-Qaeda, all which follow the extremist Wahhabi ideology. Several reports link Wahhabi donors in Persian Gulf monarchies to these terrorist groups. What are the other sources of funding for these terrorists that are well-armed and apparently powerful?
It's a good question. I know that the funding sources are as elusive as the terrorist people can be themselves. And so, but we know that there's a lot of the informal cash-based economies of a lot of the countries and the regions that make it possible for countries to have, like, for groups like Boko Haram or whoever to use couriers to move cash within the borders of a country, like say from Nigeria or across the borders. The borders in Africa are very porous, as we say. And so the neighboring countries, so it's easy to move cash around. There have been reports that I think it was Boko Haram that was able to actually raise like $70 million between 2006 and 2011. These things still exist in various illicit sources of funding operating in what I would refer to as the underworld economy. A lot of people call it just criminal, but you know, I mean, the only reason I hesitate to use criminals because who's doing the, you know, who's judging who is the criminals? A lot of the imperialists and what they do is not seen as criminal. I see it as criminal. So I just, you know, I'd rather not, you know, use that word for them, but underworld economies.
By the way, just to add on to what Mr. Freeman said, lest we forget, Donald Trump, during his campaigns before being elected the U.S. president, said that President Barack Obama was the founder of ISIS or Daesh, along with Hillary Clinton.
ISIS is honoring President Obama. He is the founder of ISIS. He's the founder of ISIS. I would say the co-founder would be crooked Hillary Clinton.
Despite the presence of mostly Western forces in Africa to purportedly combat terrorist groups, there is an increase in terrorist attacks in Africa. For instance, there are some 6,000 American troops, Defense Department civilians, and contractors across Africa. Recently, President Joe Biden also approved a redeployment of 500 U.S. troops in Somalia. Now, what exactly are these foreign troops doing in Africa since they have been unable to dismantle terrorist groups?
Actually, the fact that the groups do exist gives them the excuse they need to continue their occupation. This is a boom for the defense industries, They get to sell weapons to the African governments. They get to use their own weapons and make sure the people are the special forces and AFRICOM and the French Front Legion, all those are well equipped and have the most sophisticated weapons. So the military industrial complex, I would say, is a big part of what's happening here. I mean, we could see the militarization of the world, divorce the extremism, radical extremism, from the West's militarization of the world, particularly the United States. You know, that's all it seems to offer the world. Then there's also the fact that this militarism and the presence of the West within these countries secures what Africa has been used for all along as a source of raw materials for the use of the Western world. So the hegemony of the West and the free flow of the raw materials in Africa is a strong reason, a big reason, and admittedly so by them, for their presence in Africa.
Factors such as poverty and marginalization are said to be some of the underlying reasons that attract African youths to terrorism and extremist ideologies. Why have African governments failed to tackle some of the challenges that push mostly young people to terrorism?
Africa itself and the states in Africa, the people of Africa, not controlling their own politics and their own economics, distribution, land, all that. It's under the control of the West and foreigners. And so this is neocolonialism. Neoliberalism is that model of economics that puts profit over anything else. It values things based on profit and levels policies like austerity and privatization.
Speaking early May during a visit to Borno, a northern Nigerian state that has been targeted many times by Boko Haram terrorists, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called for global efforts to tackle terrorism.
To support humanitarian action in Borno must to recognize the enormous challenges that Borno faces with climate change, with still Boko Haram active, even if weakened, and to invest in the Borno of hope.
Now, quite clearly, terrorism is a global phenomenon. Now, what needs to be done for better international collaboration in tackling this evil?
The international level, there needs to be, and there actually are moves to do it, a reemergence of the non-aligned movement. If we remember back in the 50s and into the 60s, during the Cold War between U.S. and the USSR, that there was the non-aligned movement of countries that say we're not going to be dictated to by the Soviet Union or by the U.S. and that any relationships we have with either will be on our own terms, and that the central focus is to look forward. I remember Kwame Nkrumah said it's not to look left or look east or look west, is to look forward, is what he said. And so the principled task is the people of Africa, Asia, and Latin America, and that those as much as we can, the countries, whether they're socialists or not, really need to embark on a movement that tethers itself away from Western countries and Western imperialism. So that has to be the first program.
Southern African Development Community, SADC, has deployed troops in member state Mozambique to combat terrorism. These regional troops have been successful in drastically reducing terrorist attacks in the country's Cabo Delgado province. Speaking during a SADC summit, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa said the regional economic bloc cannot allow terrorism to thrive in member states.
We are cognizant of the magnitude of ground that still needs to be covered in the work that we have to do. Therefore, we cannot let our guard down. Terrorism cannot be permitted to continue to thrive in any part of our region.
Our last question to you, Mr. Freeman. Now, we have seen a relatively successful story of combating terrorism in Mozambique through collaboration among regional countries. Now, can these be replicated elsewhere in Africa, especially in West Africa?
Mm-hmm. Well, I have to admit, I'm not completely familiar with the programs itself, but it has to be replicated on the rest of the African continent. The Africa needs unity, and it needs a unity that that does not rely, depend on, or take directions from the Western countries like the U.S. or any place in Western Europe. And I consider the U.S. as an extension of Europe. It's a settler colony. It's an extension of Europe. And this agenda is the continuation of colonialism. It's what we call neocolonialism. So the only way forward, no country in the continent of Africa, and this was already laid out perfectly by Kwame Nkrumah in a number of books, particularly his book called The Challenge of the Congo, where he talks about how no individual African state can expect to succeed and go things alone without collaboration, full collaboration and a strategic program with the other surrounding countries within the African continent. It is an imperative that countries in Africa replicate cooperation, but also cooperation that is not rejects the designs and the interests of the Western countries.
Well, we'd like to thank Mr. Freeman for his analysis, and as he said, intra-Africa collaboration devoid of meddling by Western powers is critical in solving the security challenges facing the continent. We now take a short break before our next topic, which is on the latest developments in Mali.
Conspiring against Mali.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Mali's government says it recently thwarted an attempted coup led by army officers and supported by an unnamed Western state.
In a statement, Mali's government spokesperson, Colonel Abdoulaye Maiga, said a small group of anti-progressive Malian officers and non-commissioned officers attempted a coup in the night of May 11 to 12, 2022. The attempted coup came amid rising tension between Mali and its former colonial power, France. Mali has revoked a military agreement with France while boosting defense cooperation with Russia.
Now, all these decisions have not gone down well with the authorities in Paris. The row between the two countries further escalated after the military-led government in Mali blamed France for violating the country's airspace.
The government of the Republic of Mali.
Since the beginning of the year, the government of the Republic of Mali has noted more than 50 deliberate cases of violation of Malian airspace by foreign aircraft, particularly those operated by French forces.
Now, for more on frequent reports that France is conspiring against the government in Mali, we contacted Mustafa Shaore, a Malian academic and political analyst and the founder of An Open Eye to ORG. Thanks a lot, sir, for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Now, our first question to you, is France conspiring against the government of Mali?
The thing is that there's a correlation between the presence of the French army in some zones, in some regions, and attacks. Whenever you have the French army flying a zone, 2 days after, what people have noticed is that you have terrorists coming and attacking. So regarding this very specific case, it is very surprising that the French are not saying, they are not asking questions about who killed these people, because they know that if we check, if we do some medical checking, what is going to be revealed is that these people were assassinated a long time ago.
Mali's media regulator has ordered a definitive suspension of major French government-owned media outlets, France 24 Television and RFI Radio. Were these French media organizations working behind the scene against Mali's government?
Because there is a close link between these two media and the French government. They are, in fact, state media. They are sponsored, the subsidies they get are from the French government. They are, so it is as if you had the French army, and all the reports, all the things they were saying about Mali was not in favor of the Malian army. When there is success achieved by the Malian army, then you have nothing written on it. But each time you have people dying or a mistake done, you have, they try to, and also there is a problem of disinformation.
A French mission began in Mali in 2013 to allegedly counter militants that Paris claims are linked to the Al-Qaeda and Daesh terrorist groups. The war caused several thousand deaths and more than a million people to flee their homes. There have been 2 military coups in roughly a year amid growing demonstrations against France's military presence. Early May, Mali announced that it is cutting off its military cooperation with the French government, condemning flagrant violations of its national sovereignty by the French forces. Government spokesman Colonel Abdoulaye Maïga made the announcement on national TV.
For some time now, the government of the Republic of Mali notes with regret a profound deterioration in military cooperation with France. The government of the Republic of Mali has decided to denounce the Defense Cooperation Treaty of July 16, 2014.
The French Army's Chief of Staff described this decision as illegitimate. France is now seen as imposing itself on Mali.
France is trying to impose itself on Mali, but today we have to admit that France does not have the strength to do so anymore. So that's the big change. Things have changed, and the time when France could impose its decisions on the Malian people, on the nation, is finished. This time is over.
The move to end military cooperation between France and Mali was greeted with jubilation in Bamako.
France must leave Mali. France is here to steal the resources of Mali. France is here to colonize Mali. Leave the country without delay. They have been here for 10 years and could not solve the problem.
In our tradition, if there is a broom, it means we don't want any more. We don't want any more. The broom means that. That's why we put a stop to France.
Now, can you elaborate on the factors or reasons behind Mali's decision to end its military cooperation with France?
They have all the arguments. The Malians, they put on the table all the arguments they have just to justify, okay, this happened, so there was violation on the agreement by the French first when they decided to leave the country without noticing the Malian government or without speaking with the Malian government about it. So it was in the media that the Malians learned about the fact that the French had decided to leave the country.
Now, curiously, after the decision by Mali to end its military pact with France, there has been an increase in terrorist attacks in these West African countries. Now, Mr. Traoré, are these attacks instigated by external factors to pressurize the authorities in Bamako to let French-led West African forces continue their presence in these mineral-rich West African states?
The terrorists, they had equipment, they had guns, machine guns that are French ones, that were provided by the French. And this is why, in fact, the Mali is has doubts now concerning the French army. And this is why they're asking them to leave. Because how come the French, and the French admitted it, they said, okay, they gave some of the weapons or some of the equipment they gave to this organization, Le Ménéla, and did in the hands of the terrorists. How can you explain this one? You give weapons. You do not give weapons to the Malian army. You give it to a separatist group. And then we see that the weapons, they end in the hands of the terrorists. And this is, in fact, why France cannot say anything at the UN, because we have all, the Malians have all documents. It's all documented.
Togo's president, Farna Singbe, has agreed to act as a mediator between Mali and Economic Community of West African States, or ECOWAS. In March, ECOWAS demanded the organization of elections in Mali within 12 to 16 months.
But Mali's ruling junta rejected the demand and launched a two-year transition process before elections are held. Now, let's see what Mr. Traoré says on these mediation efforts and if there are chances of success.
What I understand is that Togolese president is in good terms with the Malian authorities. Togo is the only country trying to listen and understand the Malians. So this is one fact. The president of Mali, Assimi Goïta, he decided to go and ask the Togolese to try to work as a mediator between the ECOWAS and Mali, because none of all these other countries, part of ECOWAS, are willing to listen to what the Malians are saying. Malians are very simple. They say security first, total recovery of the country in terms of borders, and then elections.
Well, thanks as always to our guest Mustafa Traoré for his great insight on the situation in Mali. We shall keep our eyes focused on Mali and give you analysis of the situation as it unfolds. Well, and that brings us to the end of this edition of Africa Today. Thanks a lot and goodbye for now.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.